Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Current and former members of the military, what did you think when the President of the United States suggested he call upon active duty troops to take up arms to control U.S. citizens protesting across the country? Is that what you signed up for? While senior members of the military establishment have been speaking out, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, retired General Martin Dempsey, says, quote, "The idea that the military would be called in to dominate and suppress what, for the most part, were peaceful protests, that the military would somehow come in and calm that situation, was very dangerous to me." Former Defense Secretary James Mattis didn't just break his silence, he smashed it in a statement saying, quote, "When I joined the military some 50 years ago, I swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Never did I dream that troops taking that same oath would be ordered under any circumstance to violate the constitutional rights of their fellow citizens," end quote. So this hour on Point, what does this moment mean for American democracy and the civilian military relationship? And we will begin today with retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He joins us from Falls Church, Virginia. After 31 years in the Army, he also served as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005 and Special Assistant to then General Powell when Powell was Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 1989 to 1993. And Wilkerson is currently a professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. Colonel Wilkerson, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, when the president said that he would consider asking active duty troops to help quell protests in the United States, what was your first response to that?
I immediately thought about two organizations that I'm a member of right now. And let me just put a little different complexion on this, perhaps. One is the National Task Force for Election Crises, and the other is the Transition Integrity Project. As the names imply, the former is looking at everything up to the November 3rd presidential elections and has been doing so since early or late 2019. And the latter is looking at the transition November 3rd to the inauguration on 20 January. And what struck me immediately was some of the conversations that we've had in both of these groups that this sitting president might, if things turn against him in a very decisive way, or even turn against him in an indeterminate way, might use the U.S. military with regard to these elections. And that's a very dangerous situation, a very disconcerting thing. It's not that it hasn't happened before. General Grant, for example, in 1876, dispatched troops to various polling places to keep essentially the Ku Klux Klan from scaring blacks away from voting. That, you might say, was a positive use of the military, but nonetheless, it was a dangerous use of the military. We're looking at things like that right now, and between now and the 3rd of November, and even after the 3rd of November, and that it's very frightening when you see this example being set just the other day.
Colonel Wilkerson, tell me more. Who is joining you in these groups? Who's having these conversations that are seriously wondering about whether the president would use the U.S. military to interfere with a U.S. election?
You might be stunned if I were able to give you some of the names. Let's just say that it's people who've been in the national security establishment, some of them 30, 40 years, people who served in cabinet positions as secretaries for various presidents, people of both political parties and people who are independents, people who work in the precincts with state secretaries of state and voting officials throughout Michigan, Pennsylvania, Florida, Texas, and so forth. These groups are composed of people who are very concerned and wish to remain bipartisan, transpartisan, mm-hmm. even, with regard to these elections. Our goal in both groups is free and fair elections, the results of which the majority of the American people accept as legitimate. And we're looking at all manner of scenarios, and some of them involve the misuse, I will characterize it, of the U.S. military.
And how long have these groups been meeting?
The National Task Force has been meeting really since last year, vigorously since January, and since the coronavirus came upon us, almost weekly, if not more frequently. The Transition Project has been meeting now for about 2 or 3 months and is involved now in doing some exercises to determine what the reactions might be, to gain at least insights from these sort of political war games into what the reactions might be in various states and precincts and so forth with regard to the election. Let me give you one scenario, for example, that's quite frightening, that we looked at in sort of a tabletop exercise way. It's where in Texas, where you have no backup for a lot of the voting, you have no paper backup at all, in say 27 different precincts, all of a sudden you get a hack, and a high schooler proficient in hacking, and there are more of them than you might think, could eliminate some of the votes, if not all of the votes, in those precincts. There's no backup. So what does Texas do? What do the statutes in Texas require them to do? What do they prohibit them from doing? Do you have a new election? Can you do it in time? Can you do it before 14 December when the elector slate is supposed to meet in Washington? These are serious problems that we're looking at.
Without a doubt, there's profound concern over the effect, just the act of the day of voting, for sure, Colonel Wilkerson. But you also said that the groups are looking at the possibility or what might happen if the president turned to the military in November. Gaming out scenarios on that too?
We are. I have a particular insight into that because I can't tell you the individual's name, but I was recently in a senator's office, my political party. I'm a Republican. And the senator dismissed people from his office, asked me to dismiss my people who were escorting me. And he asked me a question. And the question was, what did I think the military would do if Trump lost decisively in November and departed the White House in a huff? And in that huff announced that he would like his base to come to the street with their guns. I look at the senator and I said, Senator, you just posed one of the most serious questions you possibly could about the status of this republic. I can't tell you what the military would do. I can tell you that a lot of the military voted for President Trump, especially in the ranks. I can tell you that maybe the leadership is not so inclined to be pro-Trump, but I can't tell you exactly what would happen. I can tell you what I wish would happen. That the military would, in a phrase, stay in barracks. That is to say, it would not do anything. Unless Trump were successful in getting lots of his militia, so to speak, into the street with their guns. And by the way, the FBI will tell you that the base that belongs to Trump, if you will, probably owns somewhere between 60 and 70% of the 300 to 400 million guns in America. If that were to happen, then serious results came about, then I would hope that the military would act in consonance with its constitutional responsibility and would wind up being the force that opposed that group. But we're talking about either near revolution or revolution there in some respects. So I'd rather not go that far. But I certainly am thinking in those ways because we've got to be ready. We've got to know what we're going to do or at least have some estimation of what we're going to do beforehand in case the worst happens.
So imagine there are many, many scenarios that people are thinking through. One of them you just described where you would, that in that case, believe that it might be right for the military to be the force that guarantees the sanctity of the transition of power in the United States. But you also said you can imagine another scenario where you would hope that essentially members of the United States military would defy an order of the commander in chief.
And stay in barracks. I remember an occasion in the Philippines when Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Cory Aquino, then the president of the Philippines, called us and said, can you do something? There's a Philippine captain and an entire Philippine army company getting ready to depose me. And all we did, most Americans know nothing about this. All we did was fly a couple of F-4s loaded with weapons across that company's airfield in the Philippines, and they went back to barracks. They did not try to overthrow Cory Aquino, the president of the Philippines. That's what we're talking about. The military needs, under most circumstances, to stay in barracks. And if that means defying a presidential order, then so be it. We go back to the 30s when General MacArthur, under President Hoover's guidance, moved to the Anacostia Flats with major military force to oppose the World War I bonus marchers. The man who objected to that strenuously was a major by the name of Dwight Eisenhower, and his arguments were good and powerful. But under President Hoover and General MacArthur, then the head of the Army, it happened. Fortunately, we didn't kill any bonus marchers to speak of, but we did deploy machine guns and weaponry and even artillery in order to oppose it. We don't want to see that again.
Now, Colonel Wilkerson, I must ask, we've just got a minute to go before the break. It makes perfect sense to me that that people like you who have spent their careers in the military and in intelligence services, what you do is you game out all manner of scenarios. That is what you do to be prepared for whatever might come. Did we get a glimpse as to how this moment might be handled around the president just now in the past few days when, for example, there's been reporting over the past few days that said that Defense Secretary Mark Esper, even though he walked across to the St. John's Church with the president at the same time that same morning, he was arguing vociferously in the Oval Office with the president against, you know, even saying that he'd call up troops. What about the people around the president now and how they handled this moment? We've got about 30 seconds for you to start that answer, Colonel Wilkerson.
Yes. To your question, we did get an insight, I think a vivid insight. But we also got a vivid insight into how the military might react if it became more draconian and more dangerous by all these people coming out. We have never had so many active participants from the 4-star ranks and below in protesting what a president has done in our history.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, if you stand by, we're going to talk more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what happened when President Trump suggested he would like to call up active duty military to fan out across the cities in the United States in response to the protests we've been seeing in the past 2 weeks and the subsequent response from retired and current members of the United States military. I'm joined today by retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He's a distinguished adjunct professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary. He served for 31 years in the United States Army, retired as a colonel, also served as chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell and special assistant to Powell when he was general and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff as well. And I'd like to bring into the conversation now retired General Wesley Clark. He joins us from Little Rock, Arkansas. He's chairman and CEO of Wesley K. Clark & Associates, a retired four-star general in the United States Army, served for almost 40 years, commander of U.S. Southern Command and U.S. European Command, amongst many others as well. General Clark, welcome to you.
Thank you very much, Megan.
So first of all, we will talk more about the chorus of voices rising from the U.S. military in the past few days. But I know you've been listening to what Colonel Wilkerson has been saying to us in the previous segment. What is your response to what the colonel shared about the concerns that people have about November?
Well, I think we should be very concerned. I'm very glad that Colonel Wilkerson's working on these task forces and looking through the possible contingencies. Of course, the most important thing is to educate and help the American people understand what's happening. The United States military has to remain outside the political system. It serves whoever is president. There's no loyalty personally to the person of the president. It's to the office of the presidency. He is, by the Constitution, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. When I was on active duty, I remember being at various staff colleges and war colleges. People would often ask me, what about do we have to, you know, and this was during the time when President Clinton was undergoing impeachment. What about the impeachment of our commander in chief and so on? They said, look, you're going to be loyal to the man or woman who holds the office of the presidency until they don't hold the office. That means you're going to follow lawful orders. The problem becomes for the top people like Mark Milley, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. There's a large gray area about what's the right thing, what's the wrong thing, how do you maintain a relationship. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs is the principal advisor to the Secretary of Defense. The chairman is the principal advisor to the president, and he's the principal advisor to Congress on military matters. And so he gets involved, as most of the four stars do in some way or another, in the politics of national security. And therein is the danger. Because the military is the most admired institution in America for a very good reason. And a man like Donald Trump loves that association with the most admired institution in America, particularly when it represents strength, forcefulness, the ability to get things done, all the things that President Trump is accused of not having. He wants that to rub off on him. So there's a tendency, and it's been obvious from the very start of his administration, that he wants to drag the military into politics.
And to your point, the United States military serves the United States, right? It serves on behalf of the American people.
Now, exactly right.
And General Clark, you yourself have served at those highest levels. What advice, I mean, advice isn't the right word, but how do you navigate that difficult balance that you were just talking about regarding service and the political overlap? And how should Milley or Esper do that at this moment?
These are really tough problems because you have to try to understand what your boss wants, and then you have to have some very strong positions of what the red lines are that you won't cross. One of those red lines is you don't put the troops in the streets to dominate the battle space unless it's absolutely, 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 absolutely a battle space. And of course, that was not at all the case in this circumstance. President George H. Bush and I think General Powell was the chairman at that point, did deploy troops into Los Angeles in 1992. It was at the request of the governor. It was in coordination with California authorities. The idea that the president of the United States would just willy-nilly put troops out there is just totally abhorrent. And I'm sure that General Milley and all the rest of the senior leadership feel the same way. Problem is, you get sucked into situations that maybe you didn't anticipate. And that's what looks like happened last Monday night across from the White House in Lafayette Square. Mm-hmm. So that's the danger, and you have to be on guard against it. When I was a four-star, I remember bringing a United States senator over to have Christmas dinner with the troops in Bosnia, and he said to me on the helicopter on the way back, he said, boy, must be really tough who you're working for. I said, "Excuse me, Senator." He said, "You know who you're working for." I said, "You're talking about President Clinton?" He said, "Yeah, it must be really tough, huh?" In other words, he was digging and looking for ammunition. He wanted me to say something that he could then take back to his colleagues or use on a campaign and say, "Yeah, the military, they can't stand Clinton." I mean, that's the kind of, that's the way it starts. Since the Vietnam War, the United States military has leaned toward the Republican Party because the Democrats in the 1970s and 80s were always looking for more money for domestic issues. They were always after the budget cuts and so forth. And the Republican Party sort of took it upon themselves to say, "Hey, all these military guys, they must be Republicans and they must work for me and they must vote for me." And so there's been a real struggle, and the military hasn't been exempt from that political struggle. Mm. When I was being promoted, one of the senators said to me, she said, "You stay away from that Bill Clinton," she said, "because we're going to get him." Really? I mean, come on. That's not what those are the things that happen. And when you're in uniform and you understand your duties to the Constitution and to the troops that believe in you, you stay out of that kind of stuff.
General Clark, Colonel Wilkerson, I'm going to turn back to you here in just a second. But General Clark, I want to ask you, what is it telling you that people like Jim Mattis, who assiduously followed sort of the duty to silence over the past many months, decided to speak out? And let me just read a little bit more from Mattis's statement here, right? He quotes Federalist 14, he quotes James Madison and says, quote, "America united with a handful of troops or without a single soldier exhibits a more forbidding posture to foreign ambition than America disunited." And then he goes on, Mattis goes on to say, quote, "Instructions given by the military departments to our troops before the Normandy invasion reminded soldiers that the Nazi slogan for destroying us was divide and conquer. Our American answer is in union there is strength. We must summon that unity to surmount this crisis, confident that we are better than our politics." What is it saying that Mattis is speaking out so forcefully?
I'm very happy that Jim Mattis spoke out. You know, when you go from being a military officer to take a position as a cabinet official, it's true. You were a military officer, but at that point, you're into politics. And if you believe in this country and you leave an administration for cause, I think the American people want to know why, and they want to know what's going on. And so a lot of us are very glad that Jim Mattis spoke out. I'm particularly glad that he put it in the larger context of immature leadership, a threat to the Constitution, and so forth. I hope he'll keep doing that, because it's one thing to say when you're in the military and you retire, said, "I'm not going to do kiss and tell, and I'm not going to complain about the way my boss parted his hair or ate a hamburger or something and didn't wipe his fingers the right way. I'm not going to get into that petty stuff." This is not petty stuff. Mm. What Jim Mattis is talking about is the very foundation of the United States of America. And he has a duty to speak to the American people, as do all former cabinet officials and political officials. There are a number of senators who retired. They know what's going on. They haven't spoken out. I'd like to hear more from them as well. They have a duty larger than their business relationships, larger than their relationship with the Republican Party. And we'd like to hear the people who are elected today vote their conscience rather than their party.
Well, I want to hear a moment from former Secretary of State and former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell. He was on CNN's State of the Union just yesterday, and General Powell was asked if he agrees with General Mattis's assertion that the president is trying to divide the nation. And here is what Colin Powell said.
"He is insulting us throughout the world. He is being offensive to our allies. He is not taking into account what our foreign policy is and how it's being affected by his actions. So, yes, I agree with General Allen. I agree with all of my former colleagues. And remember, I've been out of the military now for 25 years. And so I'm watching them closely because they all were junior officers when I left. And I'm proud of what they're doing. I'm proud that they were willing to take the risk of speaking honesty and speaking truth to those who are not speaking truth.
Colonel Wilkerson, you know Colin Powell very well, worked with him for years closely. What is the significance of General Powell speaking out in this way now?
I think the significance is awesome. And I go back to the General Clark's reference to the 1992 deployment, for example, of active duty military forces to the Watts riots in Los Angeles, and Colin Powell's intervention. As chairman, he was under Goldwater Nichols in particular, the latest change to the 47 National Security Act. He was authorized to do this. He went to the president and he said, "Mr. President, you're going to say some things," looking at his prepared remarks, "that are going to divide the nation even further and make this situation worse. Please listen to me and let me make some changes to what you're going to say." And H.W. Bush was smart enough to know that he was right and to listen to him. And so his remarks were aimed at unification, not division. And I think what Powell said yesterday was powerful in that regard. This is a president who, and as far as my study of post-World War II presidents goes, he's the only one, aims to divide the country for political purposes, for political power and gain, not to unify. That's unique. And it's extremely dangerous. Mm.
So Colonel Wilkerson and General Clark, stand by for just a moment, because I would like to bring into the conversation Professor Mara Carlin. She joins us from Washington. She's Director of Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, also the Executive Director of the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies as well, has served in national security roles for 5 Secretaries of Defense, most recently as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Defense and Strategy and Force Development. Professor Carlin, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, one of the things that both Colonel Wilkerson and General Clark are talking about is this fundamental question of the civilian-military relationship in the United States. Is that relationship being disturbed, redefined right now? What are we seeing?
Absolutely. So whenever you talk about civil-military relations, the first question you have to ask is, which civilians? Are we talking about the relationship between society and the military? That's one set of civilians. Or are we talking about the relationship between the government and the military? That would be like the commander in chief, right? The president or the Congress or the senior civilians like the Secretary of Defense in the Department of Defense. I think when we look at both of those dynamics, I fear that we are in a civil-military relations crisis. I think there is some real concern about what the president is or may be asking the military to do. And on the societal front, you see a real concern and uncertainty about the military's decisions potentially over these coming days or weeks.
Well, that's one of the things that that Jim Mattis pointed out in his statement, that he's concerned that it produces false tensions between the American people and the military.
Mm-hmm. He's exactly right. Look, in the post 9/11 wars, we've really had what I would call a crisis of caring. The American public has broadly supported the U.S. military, but they also have a very shallow understanding of who is in the military, what they do, and what it's like to be in the military. And as we know, in the post 9/11 wars, no real sacrifices have been asked generally of the American people. And so the agreement effectively that has been made is that the military will largely get the funding that it requests, and that the American public will applaud them at baseball games or let them board the airplane first. It's important to recognize, though, that this support is really shallow. It's flimsy. It's not based on a ton of knowledge, as a lot of research has shown. The flimsiness means it can also be lost, which means when you see the military in the street, and while folks like me or General Clark or Colonel Wilkerson will say, yes, we can distinguish between active duty troops and National Guard, that's just not going to be the case, understandably, for most of the public, right? Most of them who don't know anyone in the military. Instead, they're going to turn on their televisions or open the newspaper and say, what the heck is the military doing right now?
Okay, so this is really important because, you know, you heard General Clark say earlier about how the United States military is one of the most respected, if not the most respected institutions in the United States by the American people. And I do wonder, given what you just said, Professor Carlin, I'm just again reminded of General Mattis's statement when he said he said that militarizing, or even I'll add the president even mentioning the possibility of militarizing a response to protests. And then Mattis says, quote, erodes the moral ground that ensures a trusted bond between men and women in uniform and the society they are sworn to protect. Are you concerned about that erosion?
Absolutely. I'm profoundly concerned. This support has been pretty easy to garner because it hasn't asked much of the American public. To the extent we see over the coming days or weeks, which I sure hope we don't see, to the extent we see more National Guard in the streets, to the extent we see active duty troops potentially being called back out, I think that support will dissipate quickly. And there have been moments in our history where the military has absolutely not had the support of the American public. Mm-hmm. Look at the Vietnam War, the post-Vietnam War. That wasn't a healthy time for our society or, frankly, a healthy time to be in the military.
Well, Professor Carlin, General Clark, and Colonel Wilkerson, stand by for just a moment. We have to take a quick break. We are talking about the president, the military, and the American people. We've got a lot of members of the military who called in just now, so we'll take a couple calls when we come back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cuneo was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country, but it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the president, the military, and the American people this hour. And I just want to play a quick clip here from On Point listener Tim. He called us. He's originally from Uganda, and he says he experienced this sort of militarized talk, even militarized response in Uganda during his time protesting at his university during the reign of Idi Amin.
Freedoms in the U.S. is what brings us here, and we're so proud of what the American system, how it works. And it's very sad to see that now we're the laughingstock. Way back in Africa, the military regimes are saying, well, you guys say that you know it all now. Look what is happening. You're just like the rest of us.
That's On Point listener Tim, originally from Uganda. I'm joined today by Professor Mara Carlin. She's Director of Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, has served in national security roles for five U.S. Secretaries of Defense. Retired General Wesley Clark is with us as well. He's Chairman and CEO of Wesley Clark Associates, retired four-star U.S. Army General, served for almost 40 years, and retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson joins us as well. He's a professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary, served for more than 30 years in the United States Army, and as well as Chief of Staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell, special assistant to Powell when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs. In addition, now, if the three of you could just hang on for just a moment, we've got several calls from On Point listeners who have served or are serving in the U.S. military, and I'd love to hear from them. So let's start with Robert, who's calling us from Plattsburgh, New York. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Megan. General, Colonel, thank you for your service. I was a former officer in the Air Force, and I swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Not one man who may perhaps has gone off the rails. That's why it's critical that our military leadership takes the broad view and understands lawful orders. We use that in the Nuremberg trial to prosecute Nazis who unquestioningly followed the orders of Hitler. And it's part of the UCMJ to obey the lawful orders of those appointed over us. That's why it's important that our loyalties remain to the nation and the Constitution and not one man who should not be above the law.
Yeah. Well, Robert, thank you so much for your call. Let's hear from Joel, who's calling from Aberdeen, South Dakota. Joel, you're on the air.
Yes, Magna, General, Colonel, Professor, thank you so much for taking my call. So from a perspective of someone who is on the ground actually recruiting, I am currently an active duty member, and I am recruiting, and just like, I can't remember who said it, the main public, they don't see who it is. They don't see if it's National Guard or Reserve or Active Army. All they see is a uniform. And so when it comes to me trying to recruit young men and women to continue on, whether it's the tradition or for benefits or whatever, the actions of a few up higher are making it very difficult for us to do our jobs, particularly in states with lower propensity to actually serve their country. But just like the former officer for the Air Force just said, it's about the Constitution. Mm. It's about protecting the people of the United States and the lawful orders that go with it. A lot of people want to believe, the people that I talk to, we're not happy about the way things are going and the way we are being used, which I would say is more propaganda. So thank you very much.
Joel, thank you so much for your call. Professor Carlin, would you like to respond to Joel?
I would, and I really appreciate his comments. It's also worth remembering that the military over the last few decades has really become a family business. You've got one half of 1% of Americans serving. 80% of those serving have family members in the military. And so while he's facing these dilemmas on recruitment, I fear that those dilemmas will become increasingly outsized. A family business doesn't work if those in the family start to say, hey, you actually shouldn't follow this path anymore.
Mm. Let's go to Terry, who's calling from Melbourne, Florida. Terry, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Magna. I served during the Vietnam era, and given the distrust that I felt for Nixon back then, I have no doubt if I were serving now for a while when Trump was in office, that I most certainly would have questioned his fealty to the Constitution and the American people, and I would have refused orders.
Terry, thank you so much for your call. Colonel Wilkerson, you want to respond to Terry? I mean, he's echoing the military's own experience of history here.
Let me respond to all three. Yeah. You couldn't see me, of course, but I was nodding my head in vigorous affirmation of the comments of all three of the people. Terry, a Vietnam vet like myself, strikes a chord, a particularly resonant chord with me, because Terry might not agree with me, but I dare say from his comment, he probably would. That was a very fractious time and a fractious war, too. By the time I was a captain in Vietnam, I was questioning some of my own actions in Vietnam and certainly some of my colleagues' actions. Not questioning the military and its following the nation's direction, but questioning the fact that the nation's directions were coming from a misinterpretation, if you will, of the strategic situation in Vietnam. So that war was a very fractious war. 1968 in particular was a terrible year. 1963 was a terrible year when we had a president assassinated. We've been through these times before, and we've always managed to survive them. And one of the ways we have survived them is what Professor Carlin remarked on. The civil-military relationship has remained throughout it all, though very much in trouble from time to time, sound and sacrosanct. And that's what disturbs me today, is we have a president who has no knowledge of that whatsoever.
Mm. General Clark, you want to jump in here?
Well, I agree with, first of all, it was great to hear all three of those who called in. Look, it is about loyalty to the Constitution, where it's no question that it's difficult to recruit if you put the American military at odds with the American people. And yes, I mean, soldiers, sailors, airmen in the ranks will increasingly question the chain of command when at the top there are orders given that are questionable or put the American military at odds with the people. We don't want that to happen. So we've got to keep the military away from politics, and that's the job of the senior leadership of the armed forces. They're trying. You should see these wonderful letters that have been sent out by the top leaders in the services talking about the need for unity, pulling people together, believing in diversity, looking to solve the institutional racist issues. And by the way, they're talking about the loyalty to the Constitution. So our military leaders are doing the best they can, but they're subject to the whims of the White House and the man in charge right now.
Could I add a point on that?
Please go ahead.
Absolutely. I think the military does need to be careful of politics, but I worry a lot more about partisanship. Mm. And I think it is we should be careful of what we define as politics. So having senior military leaders speak out over these last few days about issues of racism and inclusion has been seen as political by some, but it really isn't. It's actually really important to how effective the military will be, right? A serious mm-hmm. talent management system. And so I do want to distinguish between politics and partisanship. I'd also like to note, we're referencing these letters by, or excuse me, articles by people like former Secretary of Defense Mattis and former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Admiral Mullen. You know, usually one wouldn't be terribly comfortable about these sort of letters. And I want to underscore that this is an anomalous moment. This is actually a moment where the military is looking around, and it is looking around for good leadership. And some of its current leaders are absolutely doing that, and others are not. And so being able to have signals to the force from people like former Secretary Mattis, former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Admiral Mullen, is actually tremendously important. I'd also note that a cohort of 89 former senior civilian Defense Department mm-hmm. leaders like myself signed a letter echoing many of these key points.
Well, in that letter, the letter says that the president is violating his oath. Mm-hmm. And you signed it. So that, I mean, that's as clear as it gets.
It really is. And I should note, this is a group that is usually not terribly political, if you will. It's much more of a technocratic cohort, if you will. It's a bipartisan group. You have Democrats and Republicans who've served in the Defense Department going back all the way to the time of Nixon, all of whom are profoundly worried and concerned and found the need to ensure that there were not just former military voices out there right now saying something's not right, but also former senior civilian voices, particularly given that we do have a system of civilian control of the military.
Yeah. Let's see if I can get one more or maybe two calls in here. Let's go to Max, who's calling from Lancaster, Wisconsin. Max, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing all right. Go ahead.
Great. I was in the Army in the 101st Airborne during the 60s, the Vietnam era, and we swore an oath to defend our country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And what these paid protesters, they're not protesters, they are rioters. What they're doing is against our country. This is not what it was in the 60s when Martin Luther King had peaceful demonstrations. He would be appalled what's going on right now, and our country needs to be protected. And as old as I am, I would get up and fight against this to protect our country.
Mm. Well, Max, thank you for your call. Colonel Wilkerson, would you like to respond to Max?
I don't doubt that there are some elements, and I've watched San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Washington, D.C., of course, Minnesota, St. Paul, Minneapolis. There are some elements that might fit what he described, but I have to say overwhelmingly, the majority of people don't. And to see the military called out in any respect is dangerous, but to see it called out to essentially confront peaceful protesters, as it was in Washington, D.C., that's abominable. So I'll have to disagree with him rather powerfully.
Well, I want to come back to something that Professor Carlin, that you said just a short bit ago about you're seeing signals here that that members of the military are seeking leadership right now, and that in a way, Mattis, General Clark, Colonel Wilkerson, this rising chorus of voices is trying to provide that. But let's remind ourselves, we have a sitting Secretary of Defense in Secretary Mark Esper. We have a chairman of the Joint Chiefs in General Milley. And what role should we be looking to them right now? I mean, I'm seeing here, for example, thus far, they have even refused to testify before the House Armed Services Committee in the coming days regarding the military's role in responding to protests in the United States. Professor Carlin, General Clark, go ahead, and then I'll...
I think it's a big mistake that they're not testifying, because I think that falls under what you might be confusing with this partisanship. They should be testifying at this point. And the question is, why are they not? I'm sure it's direction from the White House. But on the other hand, the chairman did send out letters, and Secretary Esper did speak out. The problem is they also have to maintain their relationships with what is a White House under extraordinary duress right now. And so they are in a very difficult, they're in the hot seat, and they should welcome the comments of men like Jim Mattis and Mike Mullen and Colin Powell, who are helping them in defining their responsibilities, their roles, and the boundaries under which they should operate.
Professor Carlin, Colonel, but I want to hear Professor Carlin on this for just a moment.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Look, even for take aside all of the substantive reasons why they should be speaking to Congress, for crass parochial reasons, Congress has the power of the purse. And so if they enjoy the $700+ billion defense budget, courtesy of the American taxpayers through the Congress, they should show up. So for many, many reasons, but again, those are just the really crass parochial reasons that they need that money. They are no doubt terrified of the White House, and they are trying to avoid coming out. And yet they have to recognize that not saying things is also sending signals. Now, it is giving space to a lot of impressive senior military leaders, like the chief of staff of the Air Force, for example, or the commandant of the Marine Corps, to actually offer signals and to send letters and all of that to the force. That's important. I would also note that there's a big difference between the Secretary of Defense and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, mm-hmm. right? The chairman of the Joint Chiefs is supposed to be chairman no matter who's in office, right? We don't think of him in a partisan role. And yet, of course, none of us can get that image out of our heads of General Milley marching in his uniform across Lafayette Square to St. John's Church. I mean, that is an image that I sure hope will be taught at all the war colleges and will be in all the history books. We're going to have to think about that. The difference is, though, Secretary of Defense Esper is a political appointee. Mm-hmm. That means he should overwhelmingly concur with the president's views and largely support them. And so we have different expectations, I think, for what each of them should do. The Secretary of Defense in particular should be trying to insulate and protect the Department of Defense from the chairman, from the president's kind of whims, if you will, over this last week or so. And I don't know that he has done a great job with that so far.
Mm. Colonel Wilkerson, we've got about a minute left to go, so I'm going to give you the last word today.
I was just going to say that you have just, Professor Carlin, and you and your questions have just highlighted one of the great problems for 3 and 4 stars in particular. They have an overall authority, to be sure, the Constitution of the United States, but they also have 2 operational leaderships. One is the commander-in-chief / president. The other is the Congress. And often those 2 entities are at odds with one another. And so that puts them at odds in their own minds sometimes. So it's difficult. Hmm. And I would add also to this the fact that the Senate right now, in my estimation, is acting despicably. The Senate is supposed to be that element of the Congress that brings a national interest, if you will, to congressional discussions and deliberations. It isn't doing that. It's bringing a very parochial, one political party, Mitch McConnell leading it, attitude to everything it does. So that's a real problem that the American people need to do something about.
Well, retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, I also formally invite you back to talk with us more sometime about that National Task Force on Election Crises and the Transition Integrity Project, if you could.
Surely.
Okay. Colonel Wilkerson, thank you so much for joining us today. General Wesley Clark, thank you so much as well for being with us. And Professor Mara Carlin, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.